welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. It's 844-967-2789. Text us at that same number. It's Monday. That means Mondays with Sandy Williams. And I don't care what anybody says. Governor Evers is a really good man with a good, sound heart and is focused on what's in the best interest of the people of the state. There's no question whatsoever.
I think he's actually interested in governing the state, you know, yeah, running the machinery of the state and not just playing politics, which is it's a breath of fresh air, quite frankly, because, you know, what was just announced, using that surplus in the truly, clearly ways that are responsive to a problem we were just discussing, right, fortuitously, plugging it into the health care provision system, which clearly is in need of capacity.
Yeah, kudos to Governor Evers. Man, just a good guy. But Sandy, I want to go back to, we were talking about the nuclear plant in Ukraine, and so they were talking about this as if, hey, this could really become a real live issue, and the fact that, and I forgot the name of the nuclear
the plant?
International Nuclear Agency.
Yeah.
That's whose job it is to oversee these things and to come in and take a look at it and to see. And the guy was showing all the shelling and the fact that Russians are still inside the plant, which is absolutely...
Well, yeah, clearly, I mean, there was, you know, there's the potential in any war for people to take safe harbor in a place that is off limits for attack.
Yeah, but a nuclear plant.
So I'm saying, the Russians basically, I think it's a war crime actually to hide in hospitals or otherwise hide in infrastructure places to put your military in a place like that so that they're given safe harbor to
do whatever they want to
protect themselves against attack by being in a place that can't be attacked. And so hospitals and schools and nuclear power plants. And, you know, the problem with a nuclear power plant is twofold. One, it has some fragility with respect to being able to be affected by rockets, for instance, and an outside assault. The greater danger probably has to do with it being isolated electrically so that, for instance, when they sever all the transmission lines to send the electricity out of Zaporizhzhia, this very big nuclear plant, this five-unit plant that's in Ukraine, then they have to shut the unit down, back it all the way off, but they can't turn a nuclear plant off. It still is going to have low-level nuclear fission going on, and you need to cool it. And so if there's no electricity at the plant, then you need to generate electricity in some local diesel, in a diesel generator that's located right on the premises. They have those there. And as long as there's diesel oil, the diesel generator can operate, although they can break down too, or they could be hit by a rocket and not operate, in which case, if there's no electricity feeding the cooling process for the nuclear plant, there's a chance that fission will go unbridled, uncooled, and you'll end up with an accident something like the scale of
Chernobyl.
I mean, you could have a blowout. It certainly would be the scale of, or greater than the scale of, Three Mile Island. And so you'd have a nuclear incident that could be a serious health problem. And the infrastructure of Ukraine poses risks. There's another risk I mentioned to you off the record, off the air, which was this big dam that's upstream on the Dnieper River, upstream from the area that's currently been liberated, Kherson, by the Ukrainians. And if that dam, which has been threatened by, I think, by Russia, or at least on the social media, it's been indicated that they are threatening to destroy the dam, release all that huge head of water that would flow down and destroy not only a lot of the town, but a lot of ecosystem and a lot of people. You know, the infrastructure is a serious requirement of advanced society, but it also is fraught with risk in a period of war. If your society is dependent on electricity and natural gas for heat, when you get rid of natural gas and electricity, you get rid of heat, and now you've got a whole lot of people living in a very frigid climate without any heat. Just imagine if all of Wisconsin was without gas and electricity. How would we do?
Well, you know, that's kind of like the future for Ukrainian people right now.
Well, that's the future at risk, is that with the attack on infrastructure, and that's what warfare brings. I mean, part of the problem I see with us tinkering around in that area and leading, which led up to this war, and you know, and I provide, there's plenty of fault to go around, and certainly the Russians who carried out the attack are most at fault, but we might well have set the table for it with our conduct. I believe we did. But in any case, a war in today's world is hell, and it's more hell in an advanced society with advanced infrastructure than it is, quite frankly, in a more primitive place. Vietnam was able to sustain a longer war because they were not as dependent on electricity. They didn't have heat problems, and so they could sustain a long-term war much longer than can be accomplished in the northern climates of an established country like Ukraine.
So Sandy, let me swing to why should the world be concerned right now about the expansion? Oh, wait, before I go there, let me go back to Ukraine, because we're at this point. Things are getting ready to slow down. Even the Ukrainian government admits there's not going to be a lot of stuff going on during this winter break. You know, you say winter break, but Russians are going to continue to lob weapons.
Yeah, I'm not sure winter. I mean, what's really difficult for war is the shoulder seasons between winter and other seasons. The muddy season when you can't move vehicles. Snow will make it more difficult, but not impossible to have ground war. And so, you know, I think there will continue to be substantial fighting during the winter months in Ukraine. I do think, however, that there is a growing amount of pressure for negotiation, and this notion that winter is a time for a potential break could create essentially an artificial break that could support negotiation and potentially a backing down.
Well, you know, Sandy, there has been some overtures, at least. Ukraine hasn't really come out and said, let's have these negotiations, but they clearly are feeling it now.
Well, actually, Zelensky, a couple of days ago, maybe it was a Biden-like slip of the tongue, said something about how it was that they were refusing to accept Russia's proposal for a short-term ceasefire for negotiations, and then it was corrected that they hadn't refused it, there hadn't been that offer. But it could well be that all of that was simply because when you're having negotiations, there's a tacit promise that nothing will be publicized about the discussions, or the discussions will be broken off immediately. So that was my read on it, was that there probably had been that offer made, Zelensky probably had refused it, and, however, Ukraine did not want to break off discussions with Russia by leaking it in a way like as they did.
So then would you say, from the perspective of the Ukrainians, certain things would be acceptable, other things are not acceptable? Crimea returning to Ukraine would be a non-starter for Russia?
Yes. Yes, I think.
And is that something that now, because it's been that way for so long, Ukraine probably would be a chip that they would be willing to say.
And as I've said before on earlier shows, I think the United States is very reluctant to let this war continue long enough for Ukraine to start putting Crimea into contest, because they know that Crimea is a non-starter for Russia. And if there's going to be a negotiated settlement here, it's not going to include the return of Crimea and Sevastopol to Ukraine. And so I don't think the United States wants to give Ukraine the hope. And I think there's a problem within Ukraine in their domestic politics that Zelensky has to play with. He was elected in large part by the coalition with the separate with the right wing of Ukraine, the people who are staunchly against any kind of concessions to Russia or any agreements with Russia. And so he can't appear weak with respect to negotiations. And I think the United States is trying to find a way to help him work his way into a negotiating posture without him losing the control of Ukraine within its own government. And so I think we in America are not so sensitive to the dynamics of what Zelensky has in-house there in Ukraine, but I don't think he's not a free actor, and he's not free to necessarily carry out a negotiation with Russia until the ground is set for it within Ukraine, with the various power groups in Ukraine.
If you were a betting man, and all things being equal, are they still at war next summer?
Well, I've seen more and more people that I've put some credence in believing that the spring will mark the end of the war. And I guess I think the more months that go on, the more likely it is that it will come to an end in the foreseeable months future. We're going to get to a year pretty quickly here, and a year is a long time for a direct conflict like this to go on.
So, do you think the Ukrainian people will, who probably after a long cold winter will be more willing to part with some things in order for there to be peace?
I do think that the ability of a people to withstand the loss of their modern infrastructure is limited, right? I mean,
right.
How long can you live with a small lamp to keep your place warm and live under 10 blankets that were sent to you from outside the country?
Right.
And during a period of war, you can fix the electrical infrastructure, but it'll break again. I mean, it's not like you're fixing it and it's now
right.
It's now more defensible than it was before. It's fixed, but another rocket could easily come and do the same thing. And understand that in Wisconsin here, if we wanted to destroy the electrical infrastructure of Wisconsin, it wouldn't be hard. The transmission lines get severed. There aren't many of them. The power plants are limited in number and easy targets. So, if you want to take out the infrastructure of a geography, pretty easy.
Listen, we've got to go to a break. 844-967-2789 is the number. It's Monday. That means Mondays with my co-host, Sandy Williams. You two can join the conversation. Hang on the phone lines. We'll come right to you. Be right back. To the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Monday. That means Mondays with my co-host, Sandy Williams. Let's go to line two. Who's on line two? Just put them on.
Paul.
Who?
Paul from Waukesha.
Oh, yeah, Paul from Waukesha. Hey, Paul, how you doing? Thank you very much for the call.
Doing very fine. Wishing both you and Sandy a happy Thanksgiving.
Likewise, my friend. Likewise.
I appreciate a show without politics.
Yeah.
I love history.
Well, okay.
In regards to Ukraine, this is my concern in regards. Putin's not going to give up. My concern is that he's just going to... Eventually, he's going to tire and get impatient, and he's just going to level Kiev. And I think he's been holding off because he really doesn't want to do that. But as you see how he's escalating it, he's going after the infrastructure. He knows exactly what he's doing. And in the beginning, I always thought that there was a deal to be made. I didn't think that Putin was wrong for doing what he's doing, but I'd like to hear what you guys have to say about Crimea. They're not giving that up. That's Russia's only warm water port. And I mean, we need to send some diplomats over there and, you know, preach for peace or some kind of a negotiation, because this is, the longer it goes, it's just going to get bad, you know. And that's Russia's backyard. Half them people, three quarters of them people over there speak Russian or identify themselves as Russian. Identify as Russian Ukrainian. Zelensky himself speaks Russian. Two of Russia's former premiers, Brezhnev and Khrushchev, were both Ukrainian. We got to figure something out over here, and we need to get the right people over there and get it going, because this is just, the longer it goes, the worse it's going to be for those people. And eventually they will turn on Zelensky. That's my.
Wow. So hang on. Let's Sandy respond.
Well, Paul, I don't disagree. I don't think I can simplify it quite the same way you do. I think that it's a complex process, both within Ukraine and within Russia. I think you are right. Number one, I think the war that Russia has pursued here was restrained to start with, will get less restrained the more they realize that what they wanted, which was to topple the Ukrainian government, to install or to have installed a much more Russian-leaning government that they could work with more comfortably, and that would have been the end of the conflict. They could have left the country, and they wouldn't need to occupy it. Now, based on the hardened situation that's occurred, based on the hostilities over all this time and all the destruction, it's much harder for them to believe that they can have that outcome. So I do believe that a negotiated outcome will be restricted to Crimea and probably to Donetsk and Luhansk, those three areas of Ukraine that would somehow be ceded to Russia, or would, and Crimea ceded, Luhansk and Donetsk maybe would retain their autonomous status that was set up in the 2014 agreements. But I think fundamentally the lesson we should learn here is sticking our nose in the hegemony of some other superpower's area and tinkering around with it in a way that we're doing it for the benefit of Ukrainian democracy, but the poor Ukrainian people are suffering mightily as the result of this, and the outcome of this might well not be very different from what they could have negotiated in 2021, when the troops of Russia were simply carrying out exercises in a ring around Ukraine.
But Sandy, we haven't learned, because we were just talking about China and the Philippines and Taiwan. Right? I mean,
yes, I think we haven't learned because our domestically we are afraid to discuss our international affairs in a sophisticated way for the American public to try and get an understanding of what's going on in the world, and instead we're treating the American public like they're Packer fans, and we're talking about things like it's the Super Bowl and we've got to win it. If that's the way we're going to think going forward, that the United States has to dominate the world, which has been the predicate for domestic politics since World War II, then we're going to have serious problems in the world, because the rest of the world will perceive that it is America's intent to dominate the world. And that might be okay for Norway and a bunch of countries who aren't interested in any sort of domination or being thwarted from their growth. But take China, for instance. The main reason we've become upset with China is not because they're a communist country. They were in 1995 a communist country, more communist probably than they are now. But what we're upset about with respect to China is the fact that they're achieving economic success to the point of something we've never seen before in another country, in another economy in the world. We've seen major economies, but they were always in a state of eclipse. England, for instance. Germany's a major economy, but we understand that it alone will never rival us. The European Union together, it rivals us, but we understand exactly what we're dealing with there. But China, is this other country that is on a trajectory to have an economy that will dominate us. And our reaction to that is that we must militarily dominate the region in which China is located, so we can't let that happen. That's called mercantilism. That's called going to war over economics.
You know, Paul, what Sandy said, what you said,
right on.
To me,
everything he says is right on, 100%.
Hey, thank you very much for the call. You know, what gets me about all of it, Sandy, is the analogy of it being a football game and the fact that we got to cheer for our team. It's where the problem is.
Yeah.
Because it's not a football game, right?
It's not.
And we are not. And nobody can tell me why we should be ruling the world. Why is it okay?
I can tell you that the veterans that I sit with at breakfast, all of whom were damaged by their experience in Vietnam, do not think that warfare is a football game, and do not think that they were playing football in the process that they were involved with.
Got to go to a break. Be right. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Monday. That means Mondays with Sandy Williams. Let's go to Tom again from L.A. Tom.
Can we talk about just the ridiculousness of war? I mean, I just don't get it. I honestly do not understand it. I know it's about power, whatever, but looking at this, if you're an alien, what is so stupid? I just find war the most stupid thing, the most expensive thing, and sooner or later, you got to sit down and talk and get to the, you know, realization. I'm really, really befuddled by the fact that we even have war. You know, I keep thinking of the song, "In Heaven There Is No Beer." That's why we drink it here. I'm starting to think that's what war is about. In heaven there is no war. Why can't we just have peace here? I just don't get it. And why people will fight for every last breath to have war.
So Tom, Sandy and I have been talking off the air about why the American people we can't ever challenge our country. Our country can never be wrong because we're Americans. And at the
root, so ridiculous.
You said what?
I said so ridiculous.
And at the root of this is, if you don't agree with what America is doing, you know, you're anti-American. You know, Sandy and I were talking about the Vietnam War, and there was the old slogan, "America, love it or leave it." If you don't like being in America, there are a lot of other places you can go. I remember those conversations.
Oh, yeah.
I like the song, "War, What Is It Worth?" Absolutely, or what's it used for? Absolutely nothing.
Right. Yeah.
What's it for? I mean, like I said, I'm not a peacenik by any means, but I guess I am in some ways, because I just don't understand. You could save so much money. Either you're going to get blown up one time and you're gone, and that's it. Or every day you die slowly because you don't have health care in this country. You don't have daycare in this country.
But you know, Tom, what we really are talking about is, why is it that we're always somewhere in the back of the room with all these wars, our name comes up?
It must be because of the fact that it's the only thing the American people seem in one way or another to agree upon. Well, I mean, maybe that's what it is. Maybe we can actually get something passed when we say war.
I was just going to get to that point, actually, Tom. I think the problem is that ever since World War II, we've had this concept that Americans must be unified on foreign policy because otherwise it's essentially un-American. So, and it's particularly
right.
true whenever we're at war. When we're at war, we have to be unified. Well, it's one thing to be unified on a public on a foreign policy that has been the subject of public debate, public discussion, where the public has played a role in reaching conclusions about what our foreign policy ought to be. But the fact is that our foreign policy ever since World War II has been made in dark rooms by institutions of our government and people who otherwise have control over our government to decide what it is. It gets announced to us. And once it's announced to us, people like Colin Kaepernick and others are required to abide by whatever it is, or they'll be blackballed, or they'll be told they should leave the country because they're. We didn't learn the lesson during Vietnam that constructive criticism of our foreign policy was a worthy thing, because everyone who lived in that period, looking back at it, understands that Vietnam was a mistake. And that all there was so much criticism of it, which was being subjected to the odious kinds of saying, you know, love it or leave it, you're un-American, you're a puke, you know, all of the odious kinds of isolation that was aimed at the people who were criticizing it. When it turns out they were right. Now we've got the Iraq conflict so recently, everyone now recognizes it was a problem, and yet the small number of people who were critical of it were isolated politically. In fact, you know, our senator was unelected, potentially as the result of his vote against it. And we end up now with a situation where we still don't debate our foreign policy. The people who want to debate it, quite frankly, are people that I find myself strangely in bed with, like Rand Paul and others, but I'm all for it. I think we ought to be discussing whether and what America's foreign policy ought to be, whether Russia is an enemy, whether China is really an enemy. What is it about the situations in the world that would justify us having a military defense budget that is based on fighting three wars on three fronts and sapping us of the capacity to do all the things for the American people?
So, Sandy, explain to me, if you will, why we are threatened by those countries. What, as an American citizen, I'm not threatened by Russia. I don't feel threatened by China. Why should our nation feel that way?
Well, you know,
the average citizen doesn't feel threatened by them.
Because I think we've gotten so used to deciding that ideological contests are, in fact, the subject of American security, as if
the
existence of a government someplace else that is anathema to our democratic process is a threat to our democracy. But we pick and choose. There are plenty of governments in the world that are not democratic, and we would not want their system imposed on us. Likewise, there are plenty of people in the world who don't want our government imposed on them. But we have decided that world domination is required because otherwise, for some reason, our safety is at risk. Is it our safety? Is it our economic situation? It's never been explained to the people, and the people just understand this as an existential fight. It's presented to the American public as an existential fight, and it isn't that at all.
There's not one American. Go ahead, Tom, quickly.
And that's part of our corporate media's fault, because they make it like it is a game. You know, it's the one thing, it's probably the one, I mean, John Kerry today would still be chastised as a traitor, whereas we got a president that just stole a bunch of secrets from the United States, and no one says anything about it, but John Kerry's a traitor because he didn't want to fight, or he was against the Vietnam War. I mean, it's just absolutely astounding. I don't know if it's because, I mean, 70% of the American people are for gun safety laws. 70% of the American people are for Medicare for all. But because 70% or 80% of the people are for war, we listen to the American people then, but we don't listen to the American people when it comes to domestic policy? Are you kidding me? I mean, this is partially media's fault.
Hey, Tom, thank you very much for the call. You know, Sandy, it clearly is something that we as the American people just bring them on. I don't care who it is, bring them on. Who do we have on the line? Who do we we have on the line?
Hello?
Yes, who do we have on the line?
This is Ron from Milwaukee.
Okay, go ahead, Ron. You say what?
I can't disagree with you and Sandy on most of the points you've been making. I do think getting away from these ideological battles would be a good thing. However, we have to put a couple of things into context here. I think Europe, Western Europe, is rightfully worried about the Ukraine war. And as major partners in NATO, we're in the driver's seat, I think. I mean, the U.S. has always got the final say on what we're going to supply. But Western Europe wants to protect Ukraine in order to protect itself. And they speak from experience. The reason NATO exists is because after World War II, the Soviet Empire decided it would start expanding westward. And before it could swallow up Western Europe, it swallowed up Eastern Europe, and NATO was created to protect. Now, that doesn't mean NATO should be around forever, but on the other hand, Putin's big argument is, well, who needs NATO anymore? You know, we're not going to come after you guys. I accept Western Europe when they say, well, we don't believe that. So we have to be a little bit careful. In terms of China, China's an unusual situation right now. It's a superpower in terms of its weaponry and military. But it's also the first country that's tried to fuse communism with Soviet-style communism with capitalism. And that is a strange mixture. I mean, to me, it's almost
explosive. It may be, but don't they have a right to do what they want to do?
Well, the oligarchy has a right to do what it wants to do because it proclaimed it did. The people don't have a
right to speak to that. China isn't an oligarchy. I don't think anyone would characterize the Chinese economy as oligarchic. And I think that the...
I'm sorry, communistic.
I'm not sure, however, that a communist government elsewhere is an existential threat to the democratic market-based system in the United States. That's the mistake I think we've made, is deciding that these government organizational processes that are ongoing in other countries, if they're different than ours, represent an existential threat to us.
And it's not our decision.
I just do want to correct a little bit of your European history, because that isn't the way the Warsaw Pact countries were created. In terms of Russia's movement to take them over. What happened was the Yalta Agreement, in which Churchill and Roosevelt participated, agreed with Stalin that the lines for the Soviet troops to march to as the Allied troops took over Europe and took it back from Germany were drawn to include the countries which became the so-called Warsaw Pact countries. And the Warsaw Pact was something that was also agreed to by the United States. So it was an agreement that the West reached with the Soviet Union to give the Soviet Union this buffer area that they claimed that they needed and wanted from Western Europe, which had posed, as far as they were concerned, so many problems for Russia over the prior 100 years. And with respect to NATO's concern about Ukraine, I think NATO was quite divided on it. And I think you'd find, if you got into the bowels of the workings of NATO, that for instance, Germany had a far different position about Ukraine and Russia than did other parts of NATO. So that I think we have some revisionist views of what's going on to explain to us why it is we're so involved with Ukraine. But I don't think it's consistent with history.
Well, I would only I accept most of what you're saying. I'm speaking rapidly here, but the bottom line here is superpowers are bad for the world in general. We're a superpower. China's a superpower. Russia's a superpower. There's really nobody else. And China is now ascending in the wake of U.S. problems and Russian problems. And if you're the Philippines, now you're worried. You're not worried about being taken over by the U.S. You're worried about being taken over by China.
Yes.
I, I, I don't care about Taiwan, but I'm sure the Taiwanese people have some feelings about that. And we are looked to as somebody that's an umbrella for these folks. Now, we shouldn't be conned into doing whatever every little country wants because of their lobbying power or, hey, Taiwan produces most of our semi-electronics right now. But we should take a more measured view of that. But you can understand why a superpowered economic... And by the way, China's economy is beginning to suffer in ways that we've already suffered. People don't want to take those factory jobs anymore. You know, they're having the same problems we are.
Well, and
but on a more
they're having a substantial real estate crisis in
right.
terms of economic crisis. No, China's, you know, the bigger you get, the harder it is to grow. It's the law of diminishing returns. China's growth rate will clearly diminish over time. But China's exercising a pretty successful pathway towards future planning. And so my point is that when you have 1.3 billion people, you might need to govern yourself in a manner that's different than the way we do, because we barely can manage 350 million, and we don't.
I guess, looking forward, though, to the post-power coming, thanks to global warming, India is going to be the largest country for very long. I think it might have already eclipsed China. I'm not sure. 2 billion people now and still growing. And
Ron, hang on a second. We got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. It's Mondays. That's Mondays with Sandy Williams. We'll be right back. And so, I already know because I talk to people. All right. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. Look, it's Mondays, and that's Mondays with my co-host Sandy Williams. And Ron, I think there was something else you wanted to say.
I'm just thinking that we need to think much further ahead. I think the superpower era is going to disappear because economic problems worldwide and the global climate crisis is going to create a serious problem with migrating populations, refugees fleeing flooded countries. Our Mexican border problem is nothing compared to what's going to happen. Borders are going to disappear because nobody will be able to protect them in any rational way. And after all, we're people of the world. We're not people of a country. And countries need to manage collectively. And that's why we really need to depend more and more on the UN and other organizations that try to treat these problems on a broader
scale. Hey, Ron, listen, man, you, what you just said was what Sandy and I have been talking about this morning. And that's the fact that America is in the world. America is not the world. And we've got to accept that, right? I mean, that backwards way of thinking that everything has to be our way, that's coming to an end, man. And the sooner people accept that, the better we're all going to be.
Amen. We have not, you know, there's this whole notion in the United States among the general populace, which has been planted there after decades of ridicule that the UN wants to be a world government that runs everything and takes us our sovereignty over. Sovereignty is a much loosely used and wrongly used word these days, and it's just wrong. You know, I mean, it's a collective body that makes joint decisions and says what's best for everybody, and what's good for this guy is good for the other guy. You know, you all have to play. We all have to do the. You know, when I was born, which before you, Earl, the world population was post World War II was 3 billion. Now it's 8 billion. It's projected to go to 9 billion. We cannot support that many people. The farmlands will disappear. They'll turn into deserts. We're way behind schedule on fixing this, and we're rattling sabers.
Well said, Ron. Thank you very much for the call, as always. Really appreciate it. Sandy?
Well, you know, the globalization, the economic globalization that has caused so much disturbance within our economy is sort of the beginning of a world government and a world norm. And my fear is that as we react to globalization by rebalkanizing, by refortifying the borders, by trying to get each country to operate independently, to be self-sufficient, a number of things are going to happen. I mean, one of them is inflation's going to go wild. It's much easier to have shortages when you have a smaller economy and a smaller supply chain. And number two, we're going to lose our interdependency, which was part of the reason for what we have had, which is a relatively long-term prevailing world peace. We've had lots of conflagrations, but we've had basic world peace. And so I think Paul's right. I don't think it's going to happen through the UN, but I do think the globalized economy and the internet, those pressures, have some promise of breaking down the ability of superpowers to pit people against one another.
So, Ron, do you think, Sandy?
Yeah.
Do you think that that we, as a nation, how do we begin to get the American citizenry to understand just how important this conversation is, and that all of us need to play a role in this? I think the more we are aware of what is going on with our nation, the more likely it is that they'll respond to what the American people clamor for.
Well, I think we need more political leadership that is capable of having discussions with people that extend beyond sound bites. And I have to say that I've been seeing more snippets of presentations on YouTube and others by Pete Buttigieg. We need more leaders like him who are fully capable of simplifying and explaining. And by simplifying, these things aren't that complicated, but they need to be discussed in a manner that is understandable and need to credit the American public with the capability of understanding the discussion so they can participate in it, so we don't have our foreign policy handed to us and then we're told that to be American we have to follow it. We don't have policies adopted that are the result of money in K Street rather than the public view of what is necessary and important. And I do think that the result of this, the overturn of Roe v. Wade, this Doe case, is an example of how we need to abide by public opinion. Ultimately, we should not continue to allow policies to be implemented which run contrary to the popular opinion. Because one of the reasons why the Democrats did surprisingly well in this last election is that there was a strong reaction to the overturn of Doe, because the American public supports choice.
You know, Sandy, the Roe versus Wade part of it, and all of those things, you know, the foreign policy all affects our day-to-day lives, right?
Well,
it does all go back to what we can afford and what we can't afford.
Yes, and a foreign policy, which I think I used to give less credence to, when you look at our budget and you realize how much we're spending on our military and defense budget, you realize that foreign policy is driving our domestic policy, because it's only that all of that huge expenditure which keeps politicians in the position of being able to say, we can't afford universal daycare, we can't afford Medicare for all, and when every other country in the world can afford it.
So, and we also know that the military budget for 2023 is going to be expanding, you know, quite a bit. And, you know, we don't have to guess. We know, based on the weapons and the amount of money that we've dished out to Ukraine, that that's going to be the case.
Yeah.
And so people need to understand why.
Well, dished out to Ukraine and promised to Philippines, and we're rapidly in the process of expanding the appetite for military expenditures.
All right, listen, we got to go. Thank everybody who made the show go. As always, Sandy, always great. Thank you, Connor. I'll be back on tomorrow. You've been tuned into the Earl Ingram Show. See you later.